This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, September 6th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. Hurricane Irma is a Category 5 storm, and it's leaving destruction in its wake as it heads towards Puerto Rico and possibly Florida. We'll have coverage on that storm later this hour, but first, the White House's decision to end DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. It's left the fate of nearly 800,000 registered recipients in question. Now, the administration says it won't be accepting any new DACA applications, and the announcement has left recipients and their families questioning their status and their future in this country. So we wanted to try to answer some of those questions, and here to help us do that is Shobha Sivaprasad Wadia. She's a professor and director of the Center for Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Penn State Law. Now, Shobha won't be providing legal advice here, we should mention that, but she's going to give us as much information as she can based on what we know from the White House and the Justice Department so far. Shobha, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here, and lots of our listeners are too, because we've gotten nearly flooded with calls here as we put out the call to listeners to ask their questions about how DACA might affect them. Let's start with Myra Rubio. She's a student and a DACA recipient in Florida, and she has a couple of questions.
My first question is, what does this mean for dreamers like myself who have a misdemeanor on record? I received this misdemeanor in Washington, D.C. during a civil disobedience. My next question is, the president has said that dreamers were not and will not be top priority for ICE. What are our options if this does in fact begin to happen? What can we do if we are detained by ICE?
Shobha, lots of people have had this question, as the White House said they're not targeting dreamers for deportation. People have wondered, in fact, if they could be targeted. And Myra there is also wondering about her record because of protest.
With regard to Myra's misdemeanor record, by the terms of the memo that was issued by the Department of Homeland Security yesterday, current DACA recipients will be permitted to retain both their deferred action and employment authorization until they expire. There is an unless clause for those who have their DACA terminated or revoked. And so whether or not Myra's misdemeanor is going to result in a revocation or a termination is unknown. My own view is that DHS shouldn't be in the business of spending resources for somebody who has DACA. If we even look at the terms of the DACA policy, having a single misdemeanor is not a disqualification for the program either. So a general response is that somebody who has DACA retains deferred action and employment authorization until expiration. I don't believe that a misdemeanor record should fall into the revocation or termination category, but that's in the hands of the administration.
Are Myra and other DACA recipients right to worry that their registration with the government, their DACA status, could turn ICE enforcement onto them and aid in deportation?
So the memo that was put out by the Department of Homeland Security yesterday indicates that after somebody has a DACA expiration, it will not be a general practice for USCIS to refer previous DACA recipients to ICE or CBP. ICE stands for Immigration Customs Enforcement. CBP stands for Customs and Border Protection. The same Q&A also states that individuals whose DACA expires will not automatically have their information shared with other law enforcement. So we do have that statement from DHS yesterday that, as a general practice, information will not be divulged to the immigration enforcement arm or other law enforcement.
All right. Well, let's hear from David from Costa Mesa, California. Now, David is not his real name. He didn't want us to use it on the air. He's a DACA recipient. He left the country. He came back in, and he has a question.
The question I have is that if a DACA recipient previously obtained entry with inspection through the advanced parole process, will they still be able to adjust their status through marriage in light of the White House's recent action?
Shobha.
We don't know how the agency is going to treat the policy that currently applies to certain individuals who are paroled in the U.S. and who otherwise meet the terms of adjustment of status. As it stands, it is possible to pursue a strategy of applying for adjustment of status following parole if the individual otherwise meets the terms of the adjustment status, so they're admissible, a visa is available, and so on.
All right, that was from David in California. We also heard from Diego, who's 19 years old, in Texas.
I was wondering, if I got deported, does it hurt my chances of returning to the country later on legally? And I want to know if by chance that if I don't get deported, can I still return to school?
Sure, but Diego is a DACA recipient who's clearly worried not only about his status in this country, but what happens if he's forced to leave.
It's heartbreaking to receive these questions, not just in the last 24 hours, but even since the election. If somebody is deported from the United States and has an order of deportation, there are consequences. Those are outlined in the immigration statute called the Immigration and Nationality Act. And so by the terms of the statute, depending on the situation, someone can be barred from being readmitted into the country anywhere from 5, 10, 20 years or forever, again, depending on the circumstance. There is a section in the statute that allows for certain individuals to apply for a permission to reapply for admission into the U.S., but the upshot is there are consequences to an order of deportation and the ability for someone to return. I do want to step back with this question a bit because I don't believe that deportation procedurally should or would be automatic. Any person who has DACA should be screened by an immigration attorney to see if there may be other durable relief available. By the terms of the program, you have to have been in the U.S. on June 15th, 2012. That means that every person with DACA today has been in the United States for at least 10 years. And so it is a good idea for any DACA recipient to see if he or she may qualify for relief from removal or an immigration benefit, for example, through an employer relationship or a family relationship. If, in fact, someone, Diego or someone else, is placed into the immigration system and a target of immigration enforcement, he or she would still go through the immigration court process in most cases. Our immigration court system is backlogged by more than 600,000. This is not a situation where deportations are going to happen overnight.
Shoba, we've been hearing from a lot of listeners who are wondering what's going to happen in Washington, D.C., either in Congress or at the Supreme Court. Here's Marco.
Hi there. My name is Marco Ornelas Mendoza. I'm originally from Wisconsin State, but because Wisconsin does not offer in-state tuition or state aid for DACA recipients, I had to move to Washington to try to go to college. Now here I am in Seattle. And my question for you is, what do you think would have happened had DACA reached the Supreme Court? If it had been ruled unconstitutional, what would have that meant for future generations?
Sure, but that's a bit of a hypothetical from Marco. There have been debates over the constitutionality of DACA, but also the corollary question is, what happens if Congress acts and passes a new law?
So to the question about what if DACA had reached the Supreme Court and ruled unconstitutional, if that had happened, I think it would have been largely political, much like the announcement we heard yesterday from Attorney General Sessions. My own view, and I've been on record several times with this view, is that DACA is constitutional and has a strong legal foundation. We have guidance from both the old Immigration and Naturalization Service and Supreme Court jurisprudence teaching us that at the heart of the exercise of prosecutorial discretion is the Take Care Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And so we actually have constitutional authorities that tell us that the government should and must exercise such discretion. There are other authorities in the statute, regulations, and so on. So I do believe that if DACA had for some reason been ruled unconstitutional, it would not have had the honesty that I would want to see as a law professor. In the case of what might happen in Congress, you know, I really hope that the events of yesterday and beyond will provide an impetus for Congress to act and pass the DREAM Act. I have to say that I am cautious about that, however. The DREAM Act has been introduced in both chambers for many years and has not seen the light at the end of the tunnel, if you will. It hasn't ever passed. But if it did, it would provide a durable solution for a number of people who currently have DACA. And so unlike DACA, which is a temporary reprieve, a form of prosecutorial discretion, the DREAM Act provides legal status, a durable solution, a potential pathway to a green card. And I don't want to overstate the point, though the narrative we heard yesterday was that DACA and the DREAM Act are either-or equations. I don't believe that. I think it was quite possible and certainly lawful for this administration to have retained DACA as well as pushed for the DREAM Act. But I encourage anyone who supports DACA or the DREAM Act to get to work because the window of time is now.
Well, DACA recipients all over the country and their families have lots of questions after the White House announces that the DACA program will end. Questions about their status, questions about their future. Shobha Sivaprasad-Wadia, professor at Penn State, thank you so much for joining us and for helping our listeners answer their questions.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. And let's go now to North Korea. Following that country's sixth nuclear test this past Sunday, North Korea's ambassador to the UN said that the U.S. will, quote, continue to receive more gift packages. The United States has said that North Korea, meanwhile, is begging for war. Now, Americans, in fact, most Westerners, were doomed to view North Korea from the outside, isolated, secretive. But not Soo Ki Kim. She spent most of 2011 teaching English to North Korea's elite at Pyongyang University, and she wrote about it in a book. It's called Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of North Korea's Elite. We wanted Soo Ki Kim to join us with an insider's view on how North Koreans see the United States, the latest escalation with the West, and their lives under the steady gaze of the great leader, Kim Jong-un.
You know, it's a very, very controlled, isolated cult that's functioned incredibly successfully. It's the biggest brand in that nation, the great leader. So you can't really lessen that by slightly. I mean, the amount of control that I saw when I lived there undercover was astounding, far worse than what I had even glimpsed or envisioned in my decade research leading into finally living there after visiting a few times and researching it for a decade.
So how do North Koreans, everyday people there, Soo Ki Kim, receive messages like fire and fury coming from the president or the UN ambassador saying North Korea is begging for war? Do they get that news? They only get it through a propaganda filter. I'm aware of that. What is it like when this rhetoric ramps up if you're an everyday North Korean?
First of all, everyday North Koreans don't get really information except their state news, which only screams about the great leader all the time, how great he is. You know, that's not that different in some way, I hate to say, to Trump tweets of how great he is. But in any case, that information is really not reaching the people. And the threat of America and fire and fury business with America is actually how North Korea perceives America anyway from the beginning. I mean, you know, the great leader is great to North Koreans because he is preventing, he is fighting for their country, protecting them from the American, imminent American attack, which split the Korea into two, the original division back in 1945. So this, you know, information, whether it's fire and fury or this threat, like none of them is new to North Korea. So it's a different way they live than here. You know, you would think that people would sort of voluntarily think about like bigger pictures, you know, even if they had that ability, a lot of that has just been squashed. And also a system is constantly controlling them where they don't wonder and run away with their curiosity. There's not a lot of time. North Koreans are constantly busy having to do duties for the great leader. Everything is watched all the time. So it just works differently, the system in there.
So, Suki Kim, you're describing a situation where you said there are lots of dead ends. Sanctions won't work. A military strike won't work. The country will never give up its nuclear weapons. And they have a culture of real religious fervor and ideology completely focused on the dear leader. That sounds like only dead ends. Are there any streets here that don't lead to a cul-de-sac, in your view?
No matter how you look at it, there's literally no other option. But people in there would have to somewhat change. And that is almost an impossible thing. But pouring information in there, any effect that might happen from that is kind of the only light at the end of the tunnel. And I'm thinking of it long term. It's not like you figure this problem out for a few years. You know, we did that actually with the last administration. It was just called strategic patience, which means literally doing nothing. Right now, we have basically the same thing, but with the president sending this, you know, very violent messages, American president. So, like, neither of those things are in any way long-term vision of what to do about this country. That's a nuclear power with a cult leader. So then the people inside really do have to, you know, not rescue, but that they would have to change so that this system of the great leader stops. And the only other light that I see is the fact that we've had three generations of great leaders. There have been three guys. And the last one, latest one, Kim Jong-un, the youngest leader in the world when he rose to power, seems, at least on surface, far more reckless. And I think that what that means is that, you know, it might be possible that we might see a regime change due to the fact that he is not as meticulous of a leader. I mean, he killed his brother and uncle within a few years of rising to power. You know, so I think that what we're seeing is possibly a leader who's not as meticulous, or, you know, there might be a problem within the country of wanting the people wanting to change the leadership. And also the world has to, I think, somehow help instigate that problem by pouring information in there.
Can the United States, can South Korea or other Western countries find a way to break through that ironclad wall of information that the great leader and his predecessors have built so strongly? Is there a way in to shine that light into North Korea?
I think that we do have to look at North Korea as a seriously deep problem of the end of humanity, where if you were to instill things, changes in there, then you do have to study it like a subject and how to find ways to pouring information in so that the system erupts. I mean, I think that's a longer, in-depth homework, but we keep sort of putting it off and sort of dealing with it momentarily until, you know, the next administration in whatever surrounding countries. And here we have, over 70 years later, the problem has gotten literally one of the most worst violators of human rights and worst threat to humanity with, you know, this sort of cult mad leader detonating nuclear weapons. I mean, there are different ways already. People are trying that. It's not working, but some dribbles, I think, are able to make way in there. When I say dribbles of information are able to make way in there. And I think that might really be the only way that the system might end.
Suki Kim, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Suki Kim is a contributing editor at The New Republic and author of Without You, There Is No Us, Undercover Among the Sons of North Korea's Elite. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Tensions are rising between the United States and North Korea, but Japan is right next door and well within range of North Korean missiles. Recent North Korean launches had Japan on high alert, and that country is now dealing with missiles flying over its territory. Here with a view from Japan is Anna Fifield. Anna is Tokyo Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Anna, welcome.
Thanks, Todd. Great to be here.
Well, we've heard these reports that Japan is considering evacuations of its citizens from South Korea, and that makes it sound like the government is at least pretty alarmed. What do things look like there?
Right. Well, the Japanese government does have the contingency plans like this. They've been in existence for some time and just get dredged up every time there are tensions like this. So I don't think it's particularly unusual right now that these talks of the contingency plans are floating around. But of course, Japanese people are very worried by the recent developments, the recent obvious demonstration of North Korea's technological advances. The most recent missile test was an intermediate range ballistic missile that flew over the Japanese island of Hokkaido. And this had people there, you know, they got emergency signals on their cell phones, there were sirens going off telling people to take cover. So this was obviously a scary development.
I'm interested in how not only the government, but the society at large feels about this confrontation. I mean, Japan is a country with a long military history, but strictly defensive in its posture today, even in the law in Japan. Do they favor diplomacy strictly with North Korea? Are there elements in Japan that talk about a more aggressive approach?
By and large, the general public favors diplomacy, favors a negotiated solution to this issue. So Japan has been pushing that at the same time as the denuclearization track has been going on. And the government has been quite reluctant to do anything that could compromise its abduction negotiations there. But things are changing because Japan really is in the firing line here. So the government has been pushing a greater militarization. They want better missile defenses. There is quite a lot of talk at senior political levels about taking off some of these shackles on the Japanese military and allowing them to have striking capability, offensive capability, not just defensive capability. And that is a strong desire amongst the Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, and the leadership in his ruling party. There is quite a lot of public opposition to this idea, but that opposition is weakening by the day here because North Korea is helping Shinzo Abe and his government make the case for Japan needing more ability to defend itself and perhaps even to attack.
You mentioned, Anna, that people in Japan are anticipating more tests. Where does this go?
Yes, I mean, it is a matter of when, not if. North Korea has been making really clear progress. They've been testing increasingly longer range missiles. So the last missile test they did, that was not an intercontinental ballistic missile. So the expectation now is that that will be next, that North Korea will shoot one of these missiles on a much flatter trajectory towards the United States, perhaps. Of course, that will have to go over Japan. So this is seen as the logical next step for North Korea to take to test its missile capability and get another step closer to being able to deliver a nuclear weapon to the continental United States.
Anna Fifield, Tokyo Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Todd. Thank you.
I am very concerned, of course, but we're very prepared. We've been working as a team for the past 5 months on protocols.
That's Ricardo Rosselló, the governor of Puerto Rico, as his island prepares for Hurricane Irma. Less than 2 weeks after Hurricane Harvey hit Texas, Irma is now on a path toward the mainland United States. The powerful storm was upgraded to Category 5 yesterday, and it's expected to hit parts of Florida this coming weekend. Meanwhile, it's making its way through the Caribbean, where it has the potential to inflict significant damage. In Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rosselló's government declared a state of emergency earlier this week. Danica Cotto is a reporter and editor for the Associated Press based in San Juan. We spoke earlier as Puerto Rico was preparing to contend with the worst of Irma.
The wind has been blowing steadily. It's been raining on and off lightly so far. And the governor expects that tropical storm force winds will start hitting the island. And the storm is supposed to pass just northeast of Puerto Rico by 8 p.m. tonight.
People in Puerto Rico, Donica, are accustomed to storms. Hurricanes are sort of a fact of life there. Of course, everyone watched Texas suffer under floods from Hurricane Harvey along with everybody else in the country. How are people in Puerto Rico reacting now?
Well, if you ask the governor, I think he's been a bit frustrated. He said that he has felt the lack of urgency, and he said that in part he believes it's because people have not experienced a storm of this magnitude. Puerto Rico has been through several storms before, most notably Georgia's. Back in, it was a Category 2 storm, but it left people without power for about 2 months. But that was a Category 2. And so now Puerto Rico's facing, you know, the wrath of a Category 5 storm. And the governor has been urging people to seek shelter. He's mobilized the National Guard and police. And right now they're evacuating people in low-lying areas across the northeast coast. So far, there's about 700 people in shelters, and the governor hopes that number will continue to grow.
Now, you mentioned his frustration with a lack of urgency. Does that mean some people are ignoring evacuation orders and just staying put?
Well, he says that if people do ignore evacuation orders, they will be removed. So it's not an option to stay put if you're in a flood-prone area. Obviously, they want to minimize any injuries and of course, any deaths. But I would say that overall, Puerto Rico has prepared for the basics in terms of, you know, buying food, buying lanterns, batteries. We saw, you know, empty shelves across the metropolitan area in San Juan and very long lines as people waited to buy water and other necessities.
Puerto Rico has had some significant economic problems over the last couple of years. We've watched them and reported on them. Is there concern that that affects the ability to respond to the storm and for cleanup afterward?
There was initial concern, but President Trump approved an emergency declaration for Puerto Rico. And this basically means that the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, it will allow them to coordinate disaster relief efforts in Puerto Rico, as well as the U.S. Virgin Islands, where he also approved an emergency declaration. So basically, FEMA decides what equipment and resources it will activate on these islands. It means that debris removal and other measures will be provided at 75% government funding. Of course, this is key for Puerto Rico, given its decade-long recession and dwindling government funds.
Still, you mentioned, Danica Cotto, regardless of the path of this storm, that Puerto Rico really has not seen a Category 5, a storm of this magnitude, in maybe 100 years. It is massive.
Correct. The last time Puerto Rico saw a storm possibly of this size was back in 1928, and that was the Hurricane San Felipe. And that killed about 2,700 people, not only in Puerto Rico, but Florida and the French Caribbean island of Guadeloupe. So people are kind of anxious. I went out this morning. I interviewed a couple of people who were finalizing, you know, last minute preparations, putting up shutters, buying gas. But most people were off the roads. It was very quiet. And I think people have taken seriously the warnings that the government has issued.
Donica Cotto is in San Juan, Puerto Rico, with the Associated Press as that island prepares for Hurricane Irma, Category 5 at the moment. Donica Cotto, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Never, not once, have I dishonored my public office.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Zwillick, and that is Senator Robert Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, there speaking today outside of a courthouse just moments before his public corruption trial gets underway for federal fraud and bribery charges. Now, this is the first time in 36 years that a sitting U.S. senator finds himself facing a federal bribery trial, but this one's important for other reasons, too. A guilty verdict here could open the door for New Jersey Governor Chris Christie to appoint a Republican in a vacated spot if Menendez were to step down. And that would mean one more Republican vote in Washington at a time of upheaval in the Senate and on Capitol Hill. Here to explain the complicated case and what's at stake for Bob Menendez and the Senate is WNYC's own Nancy Solomon. She's managing editor for New Jersey Public Radio and for WNYC. Nancy, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
Bob Menendez is alleged here, Nancy, to have woven a pretty complex web with a friend of his in the Caribbean. Bring us up to speed on the facts of the case here.
So the friend is Dr. Salomon Melgen, and he is a Florida ophthalmologist. The two men say they've been friends for 20 years. He was born in the Dominican Republic. He immigrated to the United States. He went to Harvard, became a doctor, became very, very wealthy, specializing in a treatment of problems that people have with their retina. And he gave his friend, Bob Menendez, a lot of gifts. And that's the crux of the case. He gave him airline tickets. He flew him on his private plane. Menendez was a frequent guest at his beach home in the Dominican Republic. He went to a different Caribbean resort on Melgen's dime, golf trips, expensive meals, and then hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions. So, oh, and let's not forget the very deluxe weekend in Paris. So all of this was paid for by his friend, you know, and then the case, really, the crux of it is, what did Senator Menendez do for his friend, and does that constitute bribery?
Now, his friend, Solomon Melgen, not only was a wealthy doctor, but was involved pretty heavily with government programs, right, like Medicare and Medicaid. And it seems like that might be, if there are charges of quid pro quo here, where some of the quo is.
Right. So one of the elements of the case is that Melgen was accused and later convicted of overbilling Medicare for these eye treatments to the tune of almost $9 million. So Senator Menendez did reach out to Health and Human Services when they were investigating this alleged crime, which he has been convicted of now but not sentenced. And does that constitute trying to use his influence? And really, it all comes down to, is it an official act? Is it an official act for Senator Menendez to call Health and Human Services and say, hey, you've got this wrong about this guy. He's really honest and this investigation isn't right and you're misinterpreting the situation. So,
well, let's talk about that question of an official act, because Bob Menendez, as we heard at the top, says he's never abused his office. He says he'll be proved innocent. But a lot of people, Nancy Solomon, are looking to Virginia as they look at the Menendez case, because there was a case of the governor of Virginia named Bob McDonnell, who was up on corruption charges, who got acquitted on a technicality. And now people are looking at Bob McDonnell and saying, maybe Menendez has an out here.
That is clearly what the defense is going to argue. That case is, it's exactly what this is about. And, you know, that case, it was a unanimous decision. And in the decision, the justices wrote that routine political courtesies like arranging meetings or urging underlings to consider a matter, that is not corruption. That is, the senator is using his or her influence, but it has to be an act. Like, it has to be a vote on a bill, or it has to be a rule that is passed, or, you know, some actual official act. So that's a huge case for all public corruption in the United States. But, you know, in this one particularly, where you've got these fuzzy lines of him doing favors for his friend and, you know, whether or not that really constitutes an official act.
So in that Virginia case, it was the case that favors were stipulated. Everybody knew that McDonald did favors for a rich friend. It's just that those favors weren't quite official, and that's how he got off. Now, Menendez, you're saying, may be looking for the same defense. But Nancy Solomon, no matter how this turns out, what are the stakes in the Senate here? Because Menendez is a Democratic senator in a state with a Republican governor.
It's huge. There's a very slim majority in the U.S. Senate, of slim Republican majority. And we have, you know, many issues coming up that are highly contested, including, you know, the repeal of Obamacare. And right now, of course, we're discussing the Dreamers and DACA, which is an issue very close to Menendez's heart. He has been a huge champion for immigrants, and he's an immigrant himself. So he is not automatically expelled or forced to resign if he is convicted in this case. The Senate would have to take action to expel him if he refuses to resign. But if he is forced to resign before January, then Republican Governor Chris Christie would appoint his replacement, and most certainly that replacement would be a Republican. There's even been suggestions that Christie could appoint himself, which has a lot of heads spinning.
Democratic New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez's trial starts today on multiple counts of federal corruption, the first sitting senator in 36 years to be similarly situated in front of a federal court. Nancy Solomon with WNYC and editor of New Jersey Public Radio. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thanks, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. Salman Rushdie is the author of 12 novels, but he's still best known for his 1988 book, The Satanic Verses. It earned charges of blasphemy from Islamist extremists and even led to the Ayatollah of Iran offering $6 million for Rushdie's murder for writing a book. Salman Rushdie stretched the bounds of realism and fantasy in The Satanic Verses, and he has in a lot of other books too, but in his latest novel, Rushdie is doing the opposite, contracting the surreal into a bubble of realism with a character he's been thinking about for years.
One part of this story, which is the actual story of the main character, this old rogue from India who calls himself Nero Golden, I've had that part of the story in my head for maybe 10 years. And I've been wondering what to do with him and where his story would be.
The Golden House is out this week. It's the immigrant story of a man who leaves behind a dark past in India to remake himself in the United States.
I wanted to write a completely different kind of novel set in New York, which would be like a social novel, a novel about what's going on, what people are thinking about, what's been bugging people. And then I suddenly realized that New York was a wonderful place for Nero Golden to arrive in, to perform the very American act of the reinvention of the self.
Nero Golden is rich. He's a real estate businessman with three sons and a series of wives. He longs to see his name on buildings in big letters, and he loves to boast about his dominance. Sound familiar? It should, though Rushdie insists it's Nero Golden's Indian identity that's vital here.
He really had his point of origin in Indian billionaires. You know, I mean, Mumbai, which is my original hometown, has more billionaires in it than the more or less the rest of Asia put together. So I'm quite familiar over the years, or I've become familiar with the Indian super rich. And one of the things that really interested me was the intermingling, the world of the super rich on the one hand and the criminal mafias on the other hand, and then the intermingling of the Bombay criminal mafias with international jihadists coming from Pakistan. And my initial thought was, if I can put a character in the middle of that nexus, that would be very interesting. And that became the origin of Nero, and then he gets too involved with that gangster world and tries to escape, and that's why he gets to New York. So at which point, I suppose I did, at least for comic reasons, give him some Trumpy echoes. But I'm just saying that who he is really quite unlike, you know, anyone else we know. Because really the big question that the character asks, that the novel asks in a way, is whether it's possible for somebody to be evil as well as good. So he's not really anything to do with the T word.
Part of the question of duality, it seems to me, in this book, not only with Nero, but with other people in the book, in telling good from evil or whether those things can coexist, is being able to identify evil at all or being able to identify truth at all. And that's one of the things that's very, very current about this novel as we confront, you know, questions of truthiness and fake news.
Yes.
And what are facts. That's something that threads through this, how you even start to judge whether somebody like Nero Golden is good or bad to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I do think we do live in this very strange moment in which reality itself appears to be under attack. You know, what do we mean by the real? What do we mean by truth? And it has, I mean, certainly it had an effect on me as a writer of fiction, you know, that's to say a writer of untruth. And one of the reasons why this book, you know, sort of abandons magic realism, surrealism, all this stuff that I've been associated with, is because I thought when there's so many lies out there, when there's so much fiction making being done in the real world, maybe paradoxically it's time for me as a fiction writer to start making the books as truthful as I can, you know, and so that did play a part in the form and the language, the style of the book.
I mean, the news, the current events are no place for surrealism. Novels are, but not the news. And yet we're in this moment as The Golden House comes out where so much of the news is surreal.
Yes, we're in the world turned upside down, in which, you know, a government composed almost entirely of billionaires can refer to writers, journalists, college professors as elites. it's a distortion of meaning that is, you know, it would be funny except that it's not funny.
Hmm. Salman Rushdie, it's impossible at this point, and I'm sure you know this, to read your works without thinking about the Satanic Verses, the book that brought you to the attention of so many Americans because of the fatwa and because of the bounty that was placed on your head by the Ayatollah of Iran at that time. You were accused of blasphemy, you were threatened with murder, and a lot of important institutions at the time defended protesters or wound up defending protesters, not the writer. Later, you know, a lot of people in the UK said that you shouldn't receive a knighthood for unrelated work because your very existence as a writer has been offensive to Muslims.
Well, about six people did, yeah.
They got on television, I'll say that.
Yeah.
There are jabs, many jabs, at political correctness throughout the book. I know it's an idea that's still with you, and it's one that a lot of people associate you with. So where are we at now in that ongoing struggle?
Well, I just worry that we are getting to be a kind of self-censorious culture. I worry when young people defend the repression of certain kinds of speech because they don't like it. You know, it's more conventional for a younger generation to be more iconoclastic than their parents. So, yeah, I mean, I have a lot of concerns about it. I mean, I'm not sure how big the problem is because I teach at NYU and lecture elsewhere, and I myself haven't come across students who have been trying to, you know, deplatform people or insist on safe spaces or want trigger warnings on books. I know that it's happening elsewhere, but my personal experience, I haven't had a single student talking in that way. I don't know. Maybe the problem is not as big as people make it out to be sometimes.
Or maybe it's much bigger. I mean, there's more than one observer who's posited the idea that this pent-up political correctness in America, this inability to speak honestly about things, let's say, like radical Islamic terror, you know, the phrase the president insists on using, helped give rise to the frustration and to the rage that ultimately unleashed the Trump phenomenon.
Well, I think there is a bit, I mean, there's some truth to that. I mean, I said, you know, during the previous administration that I thought it was a mistake to avoid talking openly about the linkage between certain kind of radical Islam and terrorist acts because it was obvious. When people try and deny the obvious, it erodes the ground they stand on. Clearly, the kind of Islam that they espouse is one which like 95, 98, 99% of the world's Muslims would maybe reject. But to say that it's not Islam is to make a mistake about the nature of the beast.
So Nero Golden comes to America. He wants his name in lights on big buildings. He's a fast-talking businessman. You don't call him the T word. It's obvious to some of us who read the book. But what's after Nero Golden? You haven't written the epilogue yet. What's after him in America?
You know, I truthfully don't know. I think like so many of us, I'm wondering if this is a passing phase or the beginning of a new reality. And I'm wondering quite how to deal with it as a writer. And truthfully, I've got two or three ideas about what I might do next, some of which involve getting out of the bubble and going to have a look at what's going on elsewhere in the country. I mean, I think it might be a time in which reportage is as important as imaginative fiction.
And that sounds like you're possibly getting more devoted to the idea of realism and leaving surrealism on the carpets where they are now.
For now, yeah. For now, I feel that there's a change in my personal weather, you know, and that I don't really feel like writing fairy tales right now.
A time for realism, not for fairy tales, from Salman Rushdie, who's the author of the new book, The Golden House, set in New York City right now in America in the age of Trump. Salman Rushdie, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for us today. And as always, we want to hear from you. You can give us your take at 8778MYTAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state that has instituted and prioritized the Learn to Code movement in K-12 education. Learn more about the Computer Science Initiative at arkansasedc.com. And LegalZoom.com, providing American business owners with legal advice through its network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.